So this is a talk about a important but all too often ignored problem. In classical mechanics, if I have a Poisson bracket, which is one between two variables and two other variables at the same time, quite different variables if you like, and then I can fix up a Hamiltonian in the first variables and a Hamiltonian in the second variables, which is generally a different function. But when it comes to promote those variables from C numbers, classical, to Q numbers, quantum, where I will use capital symbols for operators, the Hamiltonian quantum is not the same as the Hamiltonian quantum that this fellow built. That's an important part, and we'll use it. Now, as you can see, I'm walking carefully and losing my glasses at the same time. And I'm going to take, where's my little thing? Where's the thing I moved the... I got it. Okay. So we have one simple thing to do with the first toy model, and we have three field problems ending with general relativity. They will be all non-renormalizable, perturbatively non-renormalizable. I hate that first word, so you won't hear it again. But it has to be put in front. Here is the toy model on this single page. It is a function of time, a time derivative. Here's the time over here. Forget the G0 nonlinear term for the moment. This is like a harmonic oscillator, easily done. You know what the domain of the functions that could be there. This integral has to be finite, plus this integral has to be finite in order for the domain of that functions. However, I'm going to introduce a nonlinear term, g of 0, y to the minus 4. As y goes towards 0, which this equation of motion would tell you is okay, it's going to get greater energy and get turned around. So that's a change, a dramatic change of this behavior here. In fact, if you tend to turn on G0 and have that happen and look at the domain that is allowed currently, that would have this term, and this term all together, and that would be a very different domain than the original one we had before. In fact, if we turn it off altogether, if G0 goes to 0, the integral becomes the simple integral, but the domain has not been recovered by itself. That's what I mean by a free theory here. This is this one, but it is not a free theory when you come back to G0 to 0. The domain is quite different, and that domain is going to be with you there. So this, what I'm trying to tell you is that once you turn on this interaction, you cannot get rid of its behavior. That free is not equal to PF there, pseudo free. That has a quantum consequence. Here is the propagator for just the first two terms by themselves. These are the Hermite functions. This is the traditional energy variable values for the harmonic oscillator, and they're summing over the even and the odd Hermite functions. However, this situation when you've turned the G0 on and then turn it off again has disrupted the field here, the free thing, to a pseudo-free, and it only has the odd variables involved in this equation because they vanish at the origin. And this theta function is one only when the argument is positive, and if the argument is negative, it is zero. So these fields do not cross the axis at all after that. This is obviously a situation which is okay. You can quantize it. It will be very different. Taking the free theory by itself, this one is never going to see the free theory again. Affine quantization. You're very familiar with canonical quantization, and actually people think that is everything there is to be had. I am not a fan of that idea. I'm going to try to tell you something that's a little bit more general. Here are my classical variables, Q and P. Their Poisson bracket is 1. I'm multiplying by Q, bringing a Q to both sides, bring the Q inside, and I can get call that Q little and with little d, and that is equal to Q. Now notice that the Q cannot be zero. It can be positive or it can be negative, either way, but it cannot be zero. That's a classical story. The quantum story takes capital Q and capital P, Heisenberg operators, and this commutator is proportional to IH bar 1. Multiply by capital Q, bring the Q inside, symmetrize and anti-symmetrize that. It will, you'll notice that this anti-symmetry is just proportional to 1. That's our original equation, so this term drops out completely. It's down here. Now it's symmetric, and we'll call that capital D for dilation. This is a dilation operator, and this is a single commutator, which is the Lie algebra for the affine group. And that gives this business the name affine quantization, quantum position and dilation operators. Okay. Can we move this chair out a little bit? Yeah, okay. These are coherent states, canonical coherent states. Capital P and capital Q are self-adjoint operators with a spectrum, the whole real line. Little p and little q are C numbers, coefficient, real numbers as well of the whole line, acting on a particular vector, which doesn't matter at the moment. The action functional for a quantum mechanical story is here with the normalized vectors on each side. You can vary the psi here and you'll get the Schrodinger's equation from that there. But suppose you couldn't vary all of them. You had your hand tied behind your back and you can only choose vectors which are smaller in number. In fact, you can only choose the family up here, P and Q. So that looks down here, P of T, Q of T here, in here, and when you evaluate this quantity here, it looks like P Q dot minus H of P and Q. That looks very much like a classical C number Hamiltonian and term here, or the generator of equations of motion for classical mechanics. The thing is actually has H bar still is zero, which we except because we live in a world where h-bar is really still zero, even though we are big classical people here. What about this story up here? Okay, that's how that works. Now let's look over here at the affine coherent states. I'm going to label them P and Q as well, but the Q will have a different length. it's only going to be positive, so it can sit inside the natural logarithm of Q itself. Indeed, I want to get rid of the dimensions of Q. Let's not worry about so much about that, but we'll let Q have dimension, be dimensionless, and P absorb the dimension of the Q that's there. So this is the coherent states for this situation. I do label them similarly, but this Q has a different range. Put that into the Schrödinger's equation and vary it, you get what you want. Down here, if we had only limited to that, it's going to look very much like this kind of equation over here. This is a classical looking theory just as much as this is over here. This one we can classify this one well because we can promote it to capital P and capital Q and discuss it in our standard canonical quantization. But that's not the case in the affine world when little q is only finite. That means capital Q is only finite in its domain, and that means capital P cannot be made self-adjoint. Okay, so here's a story in which we can do that. We can take capital D in place of capital P and get something that looks classical as well. So if you were given a classical problem, you might like to do it this way, or you can do it this way, and the Q is going to be positive, and that is a clue for us when we're thinking of quantizing gravity. Question?
I have a question.
Oh, you got to speak loud, really loud.
Do you make any assumptions on small q and small p on the equation most left up? Otherwise, those two exponentials don't commute. Is that a problem? Do we have any assumptions on the commutation of those two exponentials, or this is just the definition?
Well, no, there's no definition. This is coming down straight all the way down to here. Does that answer anything?
I meant the exponentials for the definition of a canonical coherent state.
Oh, up here.
Those two exponentials, yes.
Yes? What's your question?
They don't commute unless we assume P and Q are integers up to...
No, P and Q are not integers. They are, in some block form they could be, yeah, that is true. Okay, anyway, so we're going to see what affine quantization can do for us. Now, this is related to what we had on the blackboard over there. Here is the quantum operator here. These are the coherent states for the canonical system, and the expectation value of that is this function HP and Q, which we had on the previous slide as well. Here is the O that's related to that, that's commonly used. So we can take those unitary transformations and bring them back together, and this would be expectation in that particular vector of capital P plus little p, same thing for Q, and that's going to be here. If this is a polynomial, then the only term that will survive without any h bars is this p times q. Every other term you would do in the polynomial would have an h bar situation. If h bar went to zero, then it says that the function here that you should use for quantization is exactly the function that you started with in the classical theory. That was important to Dirac, who said that he could take the classical function and put in the quantum operators there and everything would be okay. Then he had a footnote. And that footnote down on page 114 of his book says that only works if the P and the Q are Cartesian variables. Cartesian variables. Well, little p and little q in phase space do not live in a space that is has a metric. So he did not prove what he said, but he turns out to be correct, of course. Here is a situation where we can prove what his items are. I'm looking at the small distance of a perturbation of P and Q, change of a vector like that. Here, the length of the vector squared, that would be the difference between the PQ vector and the and one that's a little bit different from it. I'm going to do a take a different something over here because this takes away the phase factor that would be there. And this is only in, it's called a Fubini-Studi kind of metric here. And lo and behold, look at it, it's proportional to dp squared plus dq squared. Those are Cartesian coordinates. Those are the flat plane of P and Q that he wanted them to be. Okay, well, let's see what the affine quantization world likes. P times Q was what we struggled to arrange. Here is the Hamiltonian for that, dnq, expectation value in the affine coherent states. This is the vector for them over here. And that comes out to be this form. And again, the if you expand it in a polynomial, there would be only one term here without any h-bar. Everything else had an h-bar. If h-bar went to zero, that function then should be this function over here. Is that Cartesian? No. When you put it together in the similar kind of metric story we have here, we get something that looks different. We get q squared minus 2 dq squared with a factor b, which is proportional to h bar, and q squared times tp p squared b to the minus 1. That is certainly not Cartesian coordinates, but it is the constant negative curvature of space. This is constant negative and positive and zero curvature of space. Constant negative zero space. That's what a flat plane is of Cartesian variables. But this is that similar story for constant negative curvature. Yes, sir.
What's this variable?
You got to scream.
What's the variable b that appears in the?
What is the purpose? What purpose of b?
Yeah. What's its interpretation? What's the definition of that? It appears in the state, okay. And I'm trying to figure out what the
minus
state
two
is.
Over b is the value of the negativity of the curvature. Mm-hmm. Okay. My turn to do that. Let's go to our first model of a field theory to do story. Here is a momentum squared field. Here's a field squared by itself. Here's the interaction of fourth power. We're interested in spatial dimensions one or higher. Now, forget this guy for the moment. And that's the domain of the interaction of the integrations are into natural to you, in domain of what's the pi squared integral and phi squared integral. However, if I bring in phi to the 4, all of a sudden, the domain shrinks because there's plenty of functions which are square integrable, which are not fourth power integrable. So that is free is not equal to some p pseudo free, because if I take the limit g0 to 0, then I will find that this domain has not recovered to the original domain. Okay, so pi times phi is like p times q. It is what we do to get the affine variable. I'll call this the affine field. Again, phi should not be positive, should not be zero. Could be positive or negative. Here is the Poisson bracket for that story. And here is the Hamiltonian now in terms of kappa and phi. Classical to quantum. We take the Poisson bracket and enlarge it to operators here. Again, that we should keep the operators away from zero. This particular set of variables can be represented in B dagger B form. B dagger B form on down here. These are kind of current Minnesian current, I forget the words here, but the kind of current commutation relationship. This B is a It's the sum of an A, which is killing a lot of vectors here, and a constant term, which is okay. But rather than go through that, let's do something we are familiar with, which is using Schrodinger's representation. We'll take phi of x equal to functions, and the kappa of x having a functional derivative arrangement here. Here is Schrodinger's equation. We've put this in for the term, original term here. Here's the square, and here's the fourth power to look at it. Now there's an interesting feature of these situations. This kappa of x, which is written here, a derivative with a multiplier, and then the conjugate version of that, is actually will kill phi of x to the minus 1/2. It can annihilate that. However, we don't want to annihilate it. We want to arrange to move it. For example, this phi to the squared here could be put into four different powers and then brought through this kappa over here. That means we can use a wave function of the kind phi of x to the minus 1/2, and then some extra terms out here. That's just using the fact that this is very fortunate for our calculations. That's a formal story because this is not square integrable, but we can regularize that function. Instead of doing it over all x, let's do it over a spatial lattice. I'm making a grand effort to show you a spatial lattice, which is has a spatial lattice of spacing of A and is a sequence of integers. Now, in the regularized form, this function is changed from its behavior here. The A gets going to zero eventually. B will be a function, a constant, taking away the dimensions of A to the power S. I put in this extra term here because if we square it, this function, and integrate, then this would be the savior of the spatial integration over phis, which are going to explode here. Okay, now here's that same function again, and now I want to introduce you to the characteristic functional. Characteristic functional is the square of the ground state, let's call this the ground state, the distribution, the square of the wave function here, and its Fourier transform. If the f function here is identically zero, this is number one, then that's actually just the normalization integral. This thing is termed to be one. Let's call that one. We put in that one, which is just using this term here. And now having a one in there, I'm going to cancel that one. So this is identical to the equation above it. But now I can take the limit a to zero. A to zero goes to these regular integration variables, having a b up on the exponent here, and that's d lambda over lambda. So this is now a Poisson distribution. Poisson distribution. Okay, one might ask, is there any physics to all this that I've been talking about? When we take g zero to zero, we take the interacting theory to the free theory. And the free theory has a ground state, which is like a Gaussian, it would be typical, but we're in the pseudo-free world now here because we have had to go outside of the regular world. If this W of lambda became lambda squared, that would be its representation of the ground state story for this particular situation in the absence of any interaction. Well, okay, so if this is the Fourier transform of the ground state distribution, let's imagine doing it, looking at the square root of that, that's the ground state distribution itself, and we would find that ground state distribution comes from a Hamiltonian which has equal spacing spectrum, and it has absolutely no zero-point energy. That's a positive feature for this story. We move on now to the covariant variables. We'll put on a gradient term here. which tends to smoothen out the relation between nearby points of space. When S is greater than or equal to 4, S being the number of dimensions of this, again, we have a pseudo-free, which is not equal to the free. That makes it a non-renormalizable theory. We're doing it with the affine variables one more time. Again, they should not be 0. Here is the change of the pi field, just like we had before. Again, we take this into the Schrödinger representation for this problem. And here we already have Schrödinger's equation now for the theory with the field over. Okay, well, that covariant model still has the same story. Kappa kills phi to the of x to the minus a half. This would be its formal normal approach to do it. But we're going to regularize it. And now we're going to have a different regularization. In the case where we had no gradient, you could not tell that one point was different from another point. They were all separate points, and that's why we came to a Poisson distribution by the first place. Here we have spatial contact because of our gradient term. So what we're going to do is going to soften this here. Here's the point K in the middle, and here are the nearest points in the space dimension. Here, S equals 2 space dimensions. There's 4 points, 1, 2, 3, 4 around that. Add that to the middle one, that's 5 points. We're going to average that over 5 points. 2 times S here, it makes it 4 plus 1 is 5. This is 1/5 is the summation on of that term here. Then this is the regularization we're going to use. When we square that, this to have a vanishing here, we'd have so many terms that it would not allow any divergence to come from that. It's interesting that this situation has more advantages than you might think. Let's imagine that we have all our Cartesian integration variables and put them into what I would call hyperspherical radius. For example, let's call the sum of phi of x squared equal to rho squared. That's like a radius squared. And therefore, what's left over, the sum of the a to k's down here is equal to 1, as it appears in this delta function. We're going to take the form here, bring it down here, and take away the rhos. And that's rho coming out to rho to the minus 1. And squaring it there, that's rho to the minus 1 is a lot, multiplied by k. So that's as many as there are points in the variable. But typically in radius of situations, radius, you get the power is again as many variables there are. So that n prime, I will call it, cancels with this n prime. And what's left over is our regularization term here, r, which is finite in a finite region. And we could put a summation of phi squared to any power we liked inside that integral, and those integrals all would be finite, whereas normally they would be divergent. Indeed, there are indications that affine quantization of phi to the fourth in 4 dimensions is not trivial, although canonical quantization says it is trivial. Okay, finally we reach our gravity. Here is the metric variable function, which is greater than 0. Here is its inverse. Here is family with the momentum variable to give this mixed up and down quantity. And here is the determinant being positive. Here is in the ADM, the Arnoway. I'm forgetting A at the moment. Arnowitz, Misner, is the classical story of in the phase space. And this mixed business, it comes in here. Now, I'm going to be very kind to this mixed equation, one up and one down. I'm going to give it a special name, because we're going to build on it. The phase, the variable quantity is has a momentum in it and a metric in it. So momentum, and we're going to take away the tum part, so moment, and then the, take away the met part of metric. So this is momentric in there. That's what we're going to call it. This is the analog of what we do for the examples before. We multiply capital P times capital Q, or little p times little q. So we're going to make these our variables along with the metric itself our variables. Here is a set of three equations written as operators, but they were Poisson brackets before without the H-bar stuff. And they were promoted now to operators here, which is very different from your traditional G with a pi equal to a delta function here. For example, G to a pi here in this mixed business gives us back G's again. So we can put a minus in front of that G and still have a correct question, a correct equation. Okay, here we're going to keep only the positive terms, which we can have in this world here. Here's the B and A world that would work here. Here's the gamma matrix is restricted to this. Here is the plus on the signaling, that's the range of integration. Here's the D gamma product, etc. But again, we can use the advantage of Schrodinger's representation. G of A, B, question.
Yeah. You said the determinant should be positive.
Okay.
The determinant should be positive.
Is the determinant positive?
You said that the determinant should be positive. I'm just saying positive signature is more conditions than just positivity of the determinant.
This is the spatial metric. The
spatial metric.
Only.
Yes.
And if I tell you it's all this, of these terms here have always had to be positive, never zero, if the dx's are non-zero,
yeah.
then the metric, then the determinant will be positive.
Right. But are you imposing all of those conditions on the metric, or just the positivity of the determinant?
So somebody has to translate or help me.
I think he's asking,
are
all of the product of the eigenvalues are positive for positive determinant, but are all of the eigenvalues positive? So it's all of the three dimensions are spatial?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
The G12 does not have to be positive.
No.
But it will get fixed by its friends, by its, for example, the G, take your G matrix in your head.
No, I understand. I just wasn't sure, because you only highlighted that the determinant was positive. In that last equation that you underlined.
Here?
Just about this one, about.
The world.
Yeah.
Yes.
You only mentioned the determinant. You didn't mention all the three eigenvalues.
So the question if I finish.
Yes, please help.
The question was what the condition exactly is. So whether we are only imposing the determinant to be positive or whether we are imposing three eigenvalues to be positive.
Fine. All of the G operators commute with themselves. So they will, any choice of AB commutes with GCD. So they can all be simultaneously diagonalized. Okay. Okay. Fine. Okay, but we're going to use Schrodinger's representation again. And here, finally, is Schrodinger's equation himself for the Hamiltonian story of the gravity, the metric. Functions belong in the wave functions here and here, and we have this similar looking pi on each side along with a three-dimensional scalar curvature. And again, we have this kind of wonderful feature that the pi derivative story up here is actually insensitive to this gx to the minus a half. So this fellow can come outside out of that story And so long as there's going to be somebody else along here who really sees the derivative. And notice that we have not and will not quantize the conventional metric in this story. Okay, this is a formal statement about what the ground states and other states should look like because of this wonderful feature. And we're going to regularize that in the manner which we saw before in the previous equation with the canonical model, because they had spatial derivatives there as we have spatial derivatives in this particular term here. Now, I want to emphasize that this limits itself to metrics which are smooth because they have to undergo differentials. You'll see that coming up later. Okay, what about the affine gravity coherent states? Here is the metric C number function against the metric operator up here. Here is a new C number coefficient set here, NAB, a matrix, sitting next to the moment trick story with an operator, with a vector called beta, which is going to be like our B that we talked about briefly before. And this will end up, although it doesn't start that way, it's going to end up to be pi comma G. You'll see that. Here is the G operator sandwiched between these two terms. Now, this equation here, this blue underlined in blue, is kind of like the closest thing to Eschtekar's square root of the metric that he talks about. These eta functions, which are up here, have been exponentiated to come at this point on the front and the back, so they will never vanish here, whatever the eta's are. If the eta is zero completely up here, this is still a diagonal matrix. Then the beta variable here, the field, the vector, comes in and sandwiches between what we have chosen to be our original vector. Well, this we're going to call G AB of X, the classical term. Why are we allowed to do that? Well, let's look at what happens when the expectation value of the pi, our momentric term here, it has its pi coefficient coming from here. And lo and behold, it includes a G term here, which is satisfactorily comes from identical fashion here, which is then exactly this function coming down here, which is indeed our momentric variable, classically. When you take these two vectors together and have an inner product between them, you'll see that they involve beta x as a function, g and g prime and g double prime, pi double prime, pi prime, etc., all that. There's no longer any relevance for eta. So it's legitimate that we call these vectors inner product by g themselves. There's no spatial invasion to anything yet because this is still an ultra-local. We have not added constants imposed yet. Okay, so we've been talking about the operator of the momentric and the metric, and we're taking its diagonal matrix elements. We did that previously in the canonical case to show you what was going on with respect to the idea of the Cartesian coordinates. Here's our story here. That this is the H prime of this combination. The beta has taken these terms inside here to make the beta. And then we have a constant, where's the comma is right here, I think, is over here. I review that we just calculated this particular function here, evaluated it, look at over this one, and call that g itself. So that g comes in here at the as a lower jb. Here it is, jb, sandwiched with the metric, sorry, with the momentum of the argument of the coherent state. Down here with it, and lo and behold, that becomes our mixed classical term again. And this second fellow here actually is giving us this term here, and so we have exactly what we want when h bar goes to zero. We are told by this that the function that we should use for promoting these is identical to the original function. So these become our favored affine coordinates. Reminder, this was how we got Cartesian coordinates for canonical quantization. This is how we got affine coordinates, I will call them, when we have affine quantization. Again, this is a constant negative curvature. But look at the similarity we now have between this middle one and the gravity story. Here we have two G's downstairs, two G's upstairs. That's analogous to this situation right here. Here we have two pi's upstairs and two G's downstairs, which is exactly analogous to this story right here. So these are, again, made up of constant negative curvature terms. Okay, here's a review. Here's our coherent state story. Here is our inner product of two coherent states written in a slightly more useful form. This is a logarithm of something over divided by something. We can take those two factors outside. We can say that this is log of the numerator minus log of this one minus log of that one. That means these two logs can be taken over to the other side of just what's leaving this below. For example, you notice that there's a G tier, a G and a I and a momentum here. That's a complex combination. And this is so in a form to be called a complex polarization. So we can take this C, which is this created out of these functional derivative terms here, and act on any particular vector in this Hilbert space by this way. And that will be annihilated by that because it's actually coming back to hit these terms. So let's take this annihilator, if you will. It's adjoint, integrate over something up here, call that a capital A. This is now a second order differential equation, exponented here with a little factor nu in front of it, capital T and capital A, acting on delta functionals. And that's going to turn out to give you this term here, which is the inner product of the coherent states. This is an analog to a Wiener measure. I show you that on the next slide. Here's the inner product, now given as a integral over a functional, which has come, as you will see it again, here is the metric in this functional, like a Wiener measure, but something similar, which has the same metric that we just saw from the collection of negative constant coefficients. Here is the overlap function of that, and here is the integration variable we have. Okay, so now we're still studying quantum gravity. We need to enforce the constraints involved here. capital N is a constraint function that appears in this functional integration here, and A is also there. These N's build a projection operator. This is called the projection operator method of introducing constraints into a system where this blocks it's part of the original Hilbert space into something smaller. And that is useful in the sense that it deals with first and second class constraints if it needs to. Okay, so this is a comparison list. The canonical story that is commonly used, loop quantum gravity, has its metrics which are not typically always positive. The metric can be zero itself, and the determinant can be zero itself. Where over here, in the affine story, those are always positive. This sometimes uses complex variables, where we use real variables. Partially, it is Euclidean, which is, we are always Lorentzian over here. They have a discrete metric. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And I emphasize the smoothness of the metric in its differential equation. And so we have a continuous metric. And Carlo Rovelli recently has written about that he hopes he lives long enough to see the decision between whether you have a discrete metric or a continuous metric, and I'm offering a vote in this direction here. Here are the three basic operator stories that we have taken from the affine point of view. They've given us favored affine variables to work with. And if you have a proper affine coordinates, you'll have a valid quantum theory. Here are a couple of equations picked from the loop quantum gravity story. This variable and this variable have a Poisson bracket proportional to a unity over here. And they are, one of them is elevated to an operator point of view as a functional derivative on the other operator. Now, they are in the canonical story. They are obliged to choose Cartesian coordinates. Otherwise, if they are doing non-Cartesian coordinates, they will get a false quantum theory, as I try to indicate on the blackboard over there. So I am urging people to reconsider those variables. Well, what is today's message? Non-renormalizable models are not continuously connected to their own free theories, but they can exist. If Q and P, then Q and D automatically exist because D is just multiplied by those guys. Note that if the QP is IH bar, then QD is IH bar Q, which is the Lie algebra already of the affine group. The favored pair of P, Q and P to promote to quantum operators are Cartesian coordinates, which make up a flat plane themselves. The favored pair of Q and PQ to promote to quantum operators have an affine form. Maybe a better name for it by somebody else, but that's what I'm calling it, on a Lobachevsky plane of constant negative curvature. Canonical quantization of non-renormalizable models fails. We know that. But affine quantization can be successful. Affine quantization of gravity offers self-adjoint momentric and metric fields that respect positivity requirements. Thank you for your kind attention. Yes. Loudly.
It's not renormalizable.
Sorry?
gravity is not a prenormal item. This is the problem. Basically,
he is saying that the problem is that the gravity is non-renormalizable.
Is?
He is saying.
Yeah.
Of course it's not renormalizable by canonical methods.
Yeah, but if you do use your affine method.
I beg your pardon?
But if you use your affine method?
I do perturbation theory the way it was done by Feldman and Tohoft.
And do perturbation theory, it was done by Tohoft?
Tohoft and Bell.
And Bell.
But this is, both, is both it still, both. Does it give a renormalizable theory?
Does it then give a renormalizable theory?
Renormalizable means do I end up with a reasonable, complete context? And the answer is yes.
So it means that when you do the renormalization, you do not end up with an infinite number of parameters.
So when you do renormalization, you do not end up with infinite number of parameters?
No, not at all. Did I find a non-renormalizable story in the original ultra-local model that I did? I did not. I put in the affine field. We generalized it. We looked for the functionals of that, the characteristic functional of that. And everything was fine, finite.
Because you have a lattice.
Because you have a lattice.
Because I have a...
No, you regularize with a lattice.
You regularize with a lattice.
Oh, fine, but I took the limit A to zero. I took the lattice limit to zero at the end of that to get the Poisson distribution. That was a non-renormalizable, perturbatively non-renormalizable theory in the canonical sense.
Yeah, but back to the standard picture. If you do try to renormalize quantum gravity with perturbation theory, using Feynman graphs, the loops, the graviton loops, are not finite to all orders.
If you try to renormalize quantum gravity, then the Feynman loops are not finite.
So they...
The Feynman story requires a Gaussian free theory to begin with. And the Gaussian free theory is not in my story at the end because I am going to the pseudo-free world. Notice that the functional integral, which I put on earlier on, here, for example. Oh no, one, oh no. Right here. Here, this functional integral is absolutely requiring this regularization in its calculation. This would be the traditional integral. This is all the terms in the ADM, Arnowitz, the Dazier and Misner story. Put it up there, integrate over the variables, you get the standard theory. However, if you put in this regularization form, which is not going to give you a Cartesian story, it's giving you an affine story by automatically. And I claim that is a reasonable, possible story from an integral to do. I'm not asking for people to do that. I'm just yelling. I'm loud enough to do, so they hear about it. But if I put in there nothing, we know how bad those integrals are. If I put in there something which is a Cartesian, then I am not respecting the affine form of this proper metric here.
Well, sorry to keep asking questions. If you do something simpler, instead of using phi to the fourth scalar theory, use phi to the sixth power, which is not renormalizable.
If instead of you were using phi to 4, if you used, for example, phi to 6, which is non-renormalizable.
And do your affine.
Yeah, sure, it works fine. It works fine.
You will find
it works absolutely fine. It is an extension, of Cartesian, canonical quantization. They are classically soluble. Those things you've just been talking about, and now they can be quantum.
Phi to 6 is interacting. It's not renormalizable in normal field theory.
Phi to 6 is non-renormalizable with canonical methods. So
yes, fine.
So I guess I have to sit down and do a calculation with phi to the 6 using your affine connection, and when I take off the regularization, I will get a renormalizable theory with only a finite number of renormalization constants.
So if he takes a phi to 6 theory and will do the procedure you suggested, affine quantization, then he's asking whether we get finite number of parameters.
Yes, and I would do it for phi to the 26 as well, just as well. Yes.
You make the point that the free theory is not continuously... You make the point that the free theory is not continuously connected to the interacting theory, ultimately, because the interaction term is an unbounded operator,
yes,
and multiplying it with a small number,
yes,
still keeps it unbounded, and so we cannot simply take the limit of this small parameter going to zero and expect that the impact of the unbounded operator goes away. It won't go away. So you make this point, but then the question that follows from John's question is, ordinarily, the assumption is made that the perturbative expansion somehow captures the physics, and so the Feynman rules are derived by perturbing around the free theory, which is a useful tool,
sure,
but it runs us into non-renormalizability. So that leads to the question, do you have an analog? Can you derive something as useful as the Feynman rules, but not assuming that there is a free theory, so that we can again, go about these calculations.
The question arises, help me do it again.
So quickly summarizing, this interaction operator is unbounded, so a small perturbation doesn't give us the same. But can we, using this affine quantization, so because usually in the canonical quantization, the Feynman diagrams are, the Feynman rules are around the free theory.
Yes.
So whether we can, yes, with this method, obtain something analogous to the Feynman rules without assuming a free theory to begin with.
This equation right here is a non-traditional modification of this otherwise functional integral, which is, I'm claiming, relevant to quantization rather than irrelevant. Put it another way, if you want to have small changes of the free theory by doing a few first order terms like that, it is potentially okay, but even in the very first model we had to look at, the one with the y to the minus to the fourth power, for heaven's sakes, that is because the propagator with the two terms, it has a quantum leap, if you will, between them. And if you behave as if small perturbations around the free theory are relevant, you are kidding yourself, in my opinion.
I agree about these things. The question was, can the Feynman rules be repaired, in your opinion?
Can we get Feynman rules?
The Feynman...
Can you repair the Feynman rules?
Can we repair the Feynman rules?
I think Feynman initiated the idea of a functional integral as a procedure to solve, to help the story. This is still a functional integral, and I am guaranteeing you that this term in here, which is relevant to my limit new to infinity here, is relevant. Yes, it would be. It's harder, different, but there's a new.
I'm just trying to express the same question in a different language. Is there some perturbation theory associated with this? And if so, what are you perturbing around? You're not perturbing around the free theory. So if there is a perturbation theory associated with this, is there, and if so, around what are you perturbing?
If the perturbation theory associated to affine quantization, and if yes, what are we perturbing around?
That's, I think, the same question.
This is not the Feynman integration. He does not put in this magic regularizer.
No, forget Feynman integration.
Forget Feynman?
You told us.
help me.
It's just the same question. Is there any analog, any replacement for the Feynman diagrams in this theory?
Is there any replacement for the Feynman diagrams in this theory?
I would have to say no, because the limitations of the pseudo-free are so different from what we're used to having as a free theory that this is a great problem to look at, but I am not optimistic about it.
If you do quantum electrodynamics, you have to be able to perturb around the free quantum electrodynamic properties of the field. But the question is, if you can't do this, how do you calculate the quantum electrodynamics? How do you calculate the vacuum polarization without Feynman graphs?
In quantum electrodynamics, we use Feynman diagrams, Feynman rules to, for example, calculate the vacuum polarization. Without Feynman rules, then in this procedure, how will we calculate in quantum electrodynamics, for example, things like vacuum polarization?
I gave you an example where the interaction term was y of t to the minus 4. Let me change that to y of t to the plus 4. That is a theory that would Feynman diagrams would be very happy to have a deal with. So I'm not knocking that board, that class of problems which Feynman can help and solve. I'm only looking at problems that it fails, in my opinion, and finding an alternative mechanism, affine quantization, as a way around them. I don't want to take away all the great successes of the past. I am adding to them successes of things they could not do. Yes.
It's a different question, though. But it has to do with diffeomorphism invariance. When you introduce the regulator, it seems to me you will distinguish a particular coordinate system or a particular slicing. And the question is, what do we know about whether that breaking of the diffeomorphism invariance will go away in the limit of zero lattice spacing?
So he was asking about diffeomorphism constraint, diffeomorphism invariance. When we introduce a regulator, they choose a coordinate, so they break.
So wait, you choose.
When we introduce the regulator.
Where? We did. We, you mean me?
Yeah, you.
Yes.
You want to introduce a regulator?
Yes.
He's asking, didn't you introduce a regulator?
Yes.
And when you introduce that regulator,
yes,
you are breaking the diffeomorphism invariance and choosing a coordinate, making a choice of coordinates.
At that moment, yes.
Mm-hmm. And
then the question is, how can we be confident that when you take the lattice regular spacing to zero, that you don't preserve that distinguished coordinate choice? In other words, that you lose the diffeomorphism.
How can we then be confident that when we take the lattice spacing to zero, we still preserve the diffeomorphism invariance?
The good physics.
Yes.
You notice that I took two different lattice limits. One was where I, the ultra local one, just softened it to a lattice, whereas the one for the covariance story had gradients. I was going to have neighboring points having the same function, so I could average those several points together and not get an integral which would be divergent. So I am asking people, I have had one individual 10 years ago who solved that solution for the phi to the fourth in four dimensions, which is typically called a free theory. And he gave me a...
One good run, which is
actually on my picture, I can show it to you actually, for that theory, which was regularized differently than the conventional story. And maybe it's a good thing for me to do at the moment to do just that. So let's go there. Here is the one thing from 1982. This is phi to the four in four dimensions. This is in three dimensions over here. And you can see the thing is settling in as you're going from lattice to making the spatial distance smaller. Here is the story over here for four dimensions here. And it's going down and down. And if you actually plotted that by 1/n and look at it, it's going right down to zero at the end of the story. So that's the conventional renormalization effort from a lattice to a continuum for D4-4. Now I go one more step. This is a term with a new counter term here. And well, let's go back one. This number here has 10 things. And what is that number? That's 40 here? Right. So it is below 40. Here is my student's calculation. This is 50 here. This is 50 here. And he's got more terms, 12, which is more than his 10. And I am looking at these curves here as kind of more consistent with the non-going to zero than they would otherwise be. So this is a different regularization of its attempt to go to continuum, which is not you're not getting there, but this is taking away the lattice. And this is an effort that should show something different than triviality. Yes, go ahead.
Maybe you've got it a different way. Another question. The reason quantum electrodynamics is normalizable is because the photon has a zero mass, and the theory is gauge invariant. Now, when you take your lattice spacing to zero, do you still retain gauge invariance?
And when we
take A just lattice
to zero?
To zero. Do you still maintain gauge invariance, which guarantees renormalizability?
So in quantum electrodynamics, we have mass equals zero, and we have gauge invariance. And if we take the lattice spacing to zero, do we still maintain gauge invariance? Did I miss?
Yeah. Are you thinking about gravity or about the
electrodynamics?
So this was why it was renormalizable in quantum electrodynamics. The zero mass and gauge invariance were the reason they were renormalizable. So when we take lattice spacing to zero, do we still have gauge invariance?
I haven't studied that question. I would have, I just don't know.
I think we should move further questions to public discussion.
The reason we ask questions is because it's very interesting.
Yes, of course. But 20 minutes now.
What?
The reason he's asking many questions is because it's interesting, he said.
My wife should say nothing.
Okay, let us thank John again.